Welcome to A Quatre Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Quatre AI. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're diving deep, really deep, into the murky, rain-soaked streets of Raymond Chandler's 1939 debut, The Big Sleep. This is where American noir fiction, you know, really finds its voice. Forget neat endings. We're talking moral ambiguity here.
Oh, it's foundational.
Yeah.
Chandler wasn't just writing detective stories. People call him the poet laureate of the mean streets for a reason. He yanked the genre out of those cozy English drawing rooms and threw it right into the smog and corruption of 1930s L.A. It's gritty social commentary, really.
And that shift to the hard-boiled style, it was huge, wasn't it? It perfectly captured that post-depression disillusionment, the feeling that the system's broken, the cops might be bent, and everything respectable is maybe just a cover.
Exactly. So in a world like that, who do you get to navigate it?
You get Philip Marlowe, the template for pretty much every private eye since.
Right. And he's such a fascinating contradiction. Chandler himself nailed it. He said Marlowe has to walk down these mean streets, but the key is he must remain not himself mean, neither tarnished nor afraid.
So he's like this modern knight-errant clinging to a personal code of honor in a world that, frankly, doesn't care about honor anymore. That's his core mission, isn't it?
That's the heart of the book. And it's why the plot itself can feel, well, secondary. There's that famous story, right, when they were making the movie.
Oh, yeah, the Howard Hawks film. He asked Chandler who killed the chauffeur, Owen Taylor.
And Chandler's response, he basically said, I have no idea.
He didn't know the author himself.
Which tells you everything you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't about meticulously solving a puzzle box.
Right.
It's about watching a character try to keep his moral compass straight while wading through this absolute swamp of human corruption. Its atmosphere, its character, its theme, the plot. It's just the tangled path through the decay.
Okay, let's walk that path then. It starts, appropriately, right at the source of the rot, the Sternwood place. Can you set that scene for us?
Marlowe walks into this oppressive heat, this sense of old money just festering. The Sternwood mansion is grand, sure, but it feels choked, decaying. And then you meet General Sternwood.
The dying patriarch.
Yeah, paralyzed, stuck in his wheelchair. And he receives Marlowe in this incredibly hot, humid orchid hothouse.
That hothouse, it's such a powerful image right away. Orchids, meant to be beautiful, exotic, but grown in this unnatural, stifling heat, it just smells wrong. It smells like sickness, like secrets.
It absolutely reeks of moral rot. It's a perfect symbol for the family wealth, artificial, suffocating, unhealthy. The general himself says he likes the orchids because they have the nasty stench of life. He's literally just waiting there for the big sleep death.
And he hires Marlowe for what seems like a straightforward job, right? Handle a blackmailer, Arthur Geiger, who's got something on his younger daughter, Carmen. But it feels like the general wants more than just a problem solved.
He does. He's looking for someone, anyone, with a shred of integrity before he dies. But the real story, as Marlowe soon finds out, is the daughters. They're like these twin poles of the family's corruption.
Let's break them down. Carmen Sternwood first.
Carmen is.
Wow.
She's chaos embodied. Chandler describes her in really unsettling, almost animalistic ways. There's this childishness, but it's mixed with this raw, dangerous, completely unchecked sexuality. She thumbs her teeth, she giggles, she tries to sit in Marlowe's lap. It's purely impulsive and deeply disturbed.
Like the family's eyed running wild. And then there's the older sister, Vivian Regan. She's the opposite, right? All cool sophistication.
On the surface, Vivian's corruption is calculated, it's pragmatic. She's sharp, cynical, worldly. Her whole motivation seems to be damage control, protecting the family name, managing Carmen's messes. And she's clearly tangled up with the underworld herself, especially the gangster Eddie Mars.
And she's dealing with the biggest secret looming over everything. Her husband, Rusty Reagan, has vanished. That disappearance is the ghost haunting the whole narrative, isn't it?
It's the dark matter of the plot. And the case immediately goes sideways. Marlowe starts watching Geiger's bookstore.
Which is just a front, obviously.
Of course. A front for porn and extortion. Marlowe follows Geiger home, hears a scream, then gunshots. He goes in.
And finds what?
Geiger, dead. Shot.
Huh.
And Carmen Sternwood, completely naked, drugged out of her mind, slumped in a chair. And there's an empty camera nearby. The blackmail photos are gone.
Okay, this is a massive moment for Marlowe. The rule book says, call the police. Immediately.
But he doesn't. Why? Because his gut tells him the police are probably part of the problem, not the solution. So in this kind of bizarre act of chivalry towards his dying client, the general, he covers Carmen up, drives her home, and just leaves the crime scene.
Wow. So right there, his personal code overrides the law. He's already choosing a private form of justice, or maybe just containment.
And that choice sucks him right into the whirlpool. He goes back later. Geiger's body is gone. Vanish.
Okay, now it's getting really complicated.
And then the next day, news breaks. Owen Taylor, the Sternwood chauffeur, the one who was apparently sweet on Carmen, is found dead. His car went off a pier. Looks like an accident or suicide.
But Marlowe knows better. This isn't just one blackmail anymore. It's a web.
Exactly. The threads lead him to a guy named Joe Brody, another small-time grifter. Brody now has the photos Geiger took of Carmen.
So Marlowe confronts him.
And it's just pure Chandler chaos. Brody's trying to play tough, maybe sell the photos back. Then Carmen bursts in herself, waving this tiny pearl-handled gun, wanting the pictures back.
She's completely unstable.
Utterly. And just as that's happening, another character crashes the party. Carol Lundgren, Geiger's young lover. He sees Brody, assumes Brody killed Geiger.
And shoots him.
Shoots him dead. Right there in front of Marlowe and Carmen.
Good grief. So in like 5 minutes, Marlowe's got one killer, Lundgren, caught red-handed, another dead body, Brody and Carmen, who's a total wild card. The police must love this.
Oh, they're thrilled. They pin Geiger's murder on Brody, Brody's murder on Lundgren. Case closed, nice and tidy.
But not for Marlowe. He knows this is too neat. The big question when Rusty Reagan's disappearance is still hanging out there and he senses someone bigger pulling the strings.
This is where the real villain emerges from the shadows, even though he's been there all along. Eddie Mars.
The smooth operator.
Yeah, Mars is different. He's not just a hoodlum. He runs a respectable gambling joint. He knows people. The police seem to leave him alone. He represents that sort of systemic corruption, crime that wears a nice suit.
And he's connected to Vivian Reagan, and somehow to Reagan's disappearance.
Deeply connected. Marlowe figures out Mars is exploiting the whole situation.
Yeah.
He's blackmailing Vivian, bleeding the family dry, using the Reagan mystery as leverage. His cover story. That his own wife, Mona Mars, ran off with Rusty Reagan.
The convenient way to explain two disappearances at once.
Very convenient. And it keeps the heat off him. But Marlowe doesn't buy it for a second. He keeps pushing, keeps digging, even when people warn him off, even when things get physically dangerous.
Which leads to that ambush, right? That's a real low point for Marlowe.
It really is. He gets lured out to a remote place and jumped by Lash Canino, Mars's sadistic trigger man. Canino beats him badly, takes his gun, ties him up. Marlowe's completely helpless for a while. It shows you the real physical stakes of trying to stay clean in this world. The Knight gets his armor dented. Badly.
But he's resourceful. He manages to find Mona Mars there.
Yes. Turns out Mona Mars didn't run off with anyone. Eddie's been keeping her hidden there, basically a prisoner, to maintain his alibi.
So she helps Marlowe.
She does. Slips him a gun. And Marlowe manages to turn the tables on Canino, killing him in this grim, necessary shootout. It's not heroic. It's just survival. The cost of finding the truth.
And that confrontation, plus everything else he's learned, allows him to finally piece it all together. The truth isn't really about Eddie Mars' operations, is it? It leads back.
Right back to the Sternwood hothouse. Back to the family itself.
Right out within.
Precisely. Marlowe finally understands. Months ago, it was Carmen. Rusty Reagan rejected her advances, probably laughed at her, and in a fit of childish, psychotic rage, she killed him.
Oh, God. So Reagan never really disappeared. He was murdered. By Carmen.
Murdered. And his body is likely hidden somewhere in the Sternwood property, probably in that abandoned oil sump. Eddie Mars just found out about it later and saw an opportunity. Blackmail Vivian, keep Carmen quiet and out of an institution, protect the family name, and make a fortune doing it.
That is incredibly dark. And the climax where Marlowe confronts Carmen.
It's chilling. He takes her back to the oil field, the scene of the original crime, essentially. And he tricks her. Gives her a gun he says is his, but it's loaded with blanks. He provokes her, mentions Reagan, and she tries to shoot him, point blank.
Proving she's still murderously unstable, capable of killing without remorse.
Absolutely. It confirms the horrifying truth. And this leads us to the book's final and maybe most important statement, the resolution. What does Marlowe do now that he knows everything?
He doesn't call the police.
He doesn't. And this is where that knight-errant code fully takes over. He looks at the situation. The dying general who just wanted peace, the hopelessly corrupt legal system, the sheer ugliness of the truth.
And he decides the official channels can't handle it, or shouldn't.
Exactly. He chooses private justice, or maybe private management is a better term. His loyalty is ultimately to his client, the general, even beyond death. Revealing Carmen's crime would destroy the old man's final days and unleash a scandal that helps no one. So he makes a deal, essentially forces a stalemate with Eddie Mars.
What's the deal?
Mars has to ensure Carmen is quietly institutionalized, taken care of, kept away where she can't hurt anyone else. In return, Marlowe keeps the secret about who really killed Rusty Reagan. Mars gets away with the blackmail, technically, but Carmen is contained.
Wow. So justice isn't served. Not really. Truth is suppressed. But maybe a kind of pragmatic broken order is achieved.
That's the profound ambiguity. Marlowe upholds his personal integrity by refusing to play the system's dirty game, but the cost is letting the legal truth slide. He accepts isolation. He can't be part of this corrupt world.
It really underscores that theme of the illusory nature of truth. Sometimes the truth is just too destructive, and managing it becomes the only moral option left.
He remains the solitary knight, yeah. Bruised, cynical, but unbroken in his own code.
And we absolutely have to mention the language itself before we wrap up. Chandler's writing, it's just incredible. That hard-boiled style, it's so sharp, so evocative.
His descriptions, his similes, they're legendary. They make that whole world feel so real, so gritty, yet somehow poetic. He describes someone once as being about as inconspicuous as a tarantula on a slice of angel food. That kind of writing. It perfectly captures the bizarre mix of glamour and sleaze in L.A.
It really does. And finally, that title, The Big Sleep. It hangs over the whole book, doesn't it?
It's the ultimate punchline, in a way. Yeah. Death, the great equalizer. Marlowe sees all this scheming, this violence, this desperation for money and control, and he knows it all ends the same way. Whether you're General Sternwood in his mansion or Geiger in his illicit bookstore, The Big Sleep comes for everyone. It gives the book that deep, weary, melancholy feel.
So, reflecting on it all, maybe what The Big Sleep really teaches us isn't about solving mysteries. It's about the difficulty, the cost of holding on to your own ethics when the world around you has basically sold its soul.
Yeah, it's about that internal battle. Can you walk through the muck without getting covered in it? Can you maintain your own integrity even if it means you end up alone?
Which leaves you, the listener, with something to think about. What does it really cost us personally to maintain integrity when the official systems, the law, society, sometimes even family, seem fundamentally broken or corrupt? This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acopter Foundation.